Welcome to Inside Sponsorship, the show that provides sponsorship professionals with advice, insights, and news so they can maximize their commercial programs and achieve best practice.
FIFA Marketing, Football Federation Australia, Nike, the Brumbies, the Australian Rugby Union, and the Australian Sports Commission. Michael Thompson has held senior commercial roles at all of them, and that's why I invited him on the show to share his experiences and perspectives from all angles, the rights holder, the brand, and governing bodies. Welcome to Inside Sponsorship, Episode 7. I'm Daniel Oyston. This episode, I want to give two shout-outs to people who took the time to reach out and connect on LinkedIn and share some positive feedback on the podcast. So a shout-out to John Hessing at Tottenham Hotspur and Marty James from Sports Recruitment International. Hope you guys are doing well, and I'm glad you're enjoying the podcast. Now, before we hear from our guest this week, I wanted to share a comment someone made to Mark Thompson a few weeks back about how they settle in new sponsorship staff. And that comment was, "What I do for all my new staff to help them settle in is to make them write out all the benefits of a sponsor five times, because writing something down is the only way you can remember what needs to be done." Now, that comment struck Mark as very odd, and so he wrote a blog post with some tips about how to find the right staff for sponsorship management. I started off by asking Mark if he'd had much experience in writing lines. Mark Thompson, did you used to like writing lines at school? I bet you did a lot of it, actually.
No, I was a star student at school, Daniel.
Nobody in their right mind would believe that.
Well, I've changed. People change.
But that is actually a similar approach, writing lines, that someone you were speaking to the other day uses to get their staff up to speed with their sponsorship agreements.
Yep. Pretty old school. Very old school psychology as well. But maybe that guy went to private school.
Is it them trying to teach somebody a lesson, or what's the theory behind trying to get them to write it down a lot?
Well, when I was talking to them, they said to me, if they make them write them down five times, it's the only way they'll actually remember everything they need to deliver to somebody. So they're banking on memory for delivery.
Right. Good approach, you reckon?
We'll get to that.
Well, it's hard to find good staff full stop, let alone a good sponsorship manager, but it's important to get it right, isn't it?
Oh, it is very important to get it right. I mean, one thing you need to understand about sponsorship manager roles is that this person is the conduit between you and the whole lot of stakeholders that are in most chances, the largest financial contributors to your organisation. So it's a very important role to get right.
And so you blogged about five tips for finding the right staff most of the time.
Yep.
Number one, it seems pretty essential to me when I read it, knowing what you want, but it's often assumed or skimmed over.
Yeah, look, what I kind of mean here is that a lot of people just have standard position descriptions and templates that they just say, okay, we've got a job, here's the job, here's the skills, send it out. And then they wonder why they keep getting the same people that apply for the jobs. And a lot of people, the people that apply that are worthy employees actually will tailor their application based off what they read that you guys want. And, you know, what I'm saying there is what you really want or need in a person is it's based on what skills you've already got in the organisation, what your current set of partners want to be given value. Like, there's lots of different things that change all the time in an organisation which dictate the type of person you need in a role to be good at it.
And one of the other points is probably that whoever the commercial manager is employing or trying to recruit for a sponsorship manager, they may have not even written that job description. They may have come afterwards.
Yep.
And so just pulling it out and blindly saying, yep, let's go and find somebody that suits this, isn't even going back over and, like you said, looking at the current situation. Does it need adjusting? It might need adjusting up or down. It might be fine.
Yep.
But don't just pull it out and send it out.
Yeah, actually, before I wrote this blog, I spoke to a person who's a HR manager, and I said to them, you know, the really good job applications, the really successful appointments you've made, what's the sort of key thing that you've been through to do that? And they said, we reverse engineer the type of person we want to be interviewing and then think about what sort of things they would have written to us to get to that point and the questions we need to ask for them to actually answer that.
It's good idea that. So aligning the right person with who they'll be interacting with is also important. But you can't just look at it and go, oh, it's just the sponsors.
Yeah, that's right. And it's not when I, that's point two, understanding the audience that you're talking to. When I say I'm not just talking about the audience of sponsors that need to be serviced, I'm also talking about the demographic that you sell to, but also the audience you're targeting to recruit from. So, you know, you might want somebody who's a gun partnership manager and good at sales. There's no point then going out and saying, you know, we want somebody who's a relationship expert, you know, something like that. You've got to actually know the type of person you want to draw out, but also then the skills that are going to be needed from that person to speak to your sponsors, and also somebody who's bringing some new skills to your organisation who's going to be able to attract the next generation of audience.
Would you go as far down to look at the types of communication preferences that the sponsors have and making sure that somebody coming in has those skills or is able to communicate like that?
Yeah, I think, I mean, different generations of people bring different skills, and that includes different methods of communication. You know, people aren't going to write handwritten letters to sponsors anymore, or you know, generally writes, you know, even notes on the computer to sponsors. They'll record notes well and stuff, but they'll use more modern technologies to communicate, things like social platforms and, you know, email and stuff like that. That's all still really important, but the next generation of kids coming through and people that are coming out of uni and being educated in a totally different way to what you and I were.
And businesses quite often talk about understanding that, but as a manager, I think it's also probably your job to educate those younger people coming through, mm-hmm. that people do have different communication styles, and it's part of your job to match communication styles with your key stakeholders, your sponsors.
Yep.
Go and speak to Bob, the grey-haired, grey-suited, maybe a little bit portly general manager of ABC Constructions.
Yep.
And when you have a coffee with him, say, do you prefer phone calls, texts? I'm really busy. I can never take phone calls, but I do emails late at night, so I'll make sure I get back to you every night. That's an important step.
Exactly right. And people have their own methods of doing things. They just need to, you need to understand how that is as well. I haven't written about this, but one of the biggest frustrations I have as sitting as an executive at you know, multiple organisations is seeing skills of staff go unrecognised because they've got a certain job to do and they don't need to draw on that skill set. And I think it's the role of the manager to actually know the broader skill set of all their staff, because there may be opportunity then to utilise those, to incorporate them into your role. But also when you're looking to promote staff or, you know, create diversity in your workplace, some sort of knowledge of what your people have done in the past or have the ability to do could save you a lot of time and money.
Mm. And so the right skills now is critical, but they'll need room to grow. That's number three, isn't it?
Yeah, number three is looking for skills. So you've got a set of skills that you want to employ people, but there's a harsh reality in sponsorship management is that there is a high turnover of staff. Not many people stay in these roles for a long period of time. You know, there's a few exceptions when they're working at a place they're, you know, really, really passionate about. But, you know, when you've got a group of people and you look at a sponsorship manager, a typical sponsorship manager, they're likable people, they get along with people well, they're commercially minded. So these are the sorts of people that actually progress their careers quite
quickly.
They become
attractive to other organisations.
Exactly, because they've got a lot of, you know, information and you know, a broad range of relationships that they can draw on and actually take to other places as well. And they're attractive, but they also climb the corporate ladder quite quickly because they've got those relationship and commercial skills. So you mentioned just before, one of the roles of a manager is to find people that have the skills you need, but also the ability to grow within the role, because they will grow quickly within these roles.
They're going to grow whether you allow it, so to speak, or not. So yep. You may as well be part of it and help shape it.
Yeah, exactly right. And, you know, the people in these roles will grow quicker than somebody who's working in a finance role or something like that, because they are so vibrant normally. You know, the people we go and see day to day through what we do, they're all really affable people. So they have the ability to adapt and move really quickly.
So number four falls squarely on the rights holder, and that is to help provide the right environment.
Yep. This gets back to the quote. you know, the modern day employees are not the same as you and I, old school staff that have come through the old school of sitting in lectures and writing notes and writing essays.
Turning up at the same time every day.
Exactly right. And, you know, just actually having a, if you look back on it compared to now and what we do.
We did awesome just to survive, you and I. Plenty of people said we wouldn't.
I think some people would say our bosses did awesome just to survive, but
or to get rid of us.
Yeah, well, they did well there. But the big thing there is that education backgrounds are different. Digital and communication environments are different. The attitudes of people these days are different as well. So you've got to provide an environment that actually, you know, enhances that and actually helps people feel comfortable and want to thrive and do well in the organisation, rather than just think every day I'm turning up to work, it's just a job, I've got to go, I'll do my hours, I'll go home, because you'll never draw the right people out.
It's an interesting point because I'm not sure if many of the listeners know, but I do a little bit of tutoring out at university, and we were having a conversation last week in class about, put your hand up if you've ever had really poor IT, which is part of your environment, that hindered you doing your job. Lots of people put their hand up. Most of our listeners are probably driving along, nodding, going, yes, I agree. And the point I made there was, you're probably getting through enough work, but how many of you want to do more and could do a better job if you just had the tools in the environment to do it? Don't overlook simple things like, do you have a computer that is quick? Because I reckon in a lot of jobs I've worked in, I could get 50% more work done if I didn't have to turn the computer on, then wait 5 minutes and go and make a coffee, and that's still not ready. And so just even, it's not just the environment and the vibe and the culture, it's also the tools that you're actually giving people.
Yeah, it's the castle, it's the vibe.
That's it.
Yeah, no, but sort of still on that point, that whole quote that we open, my blog opens with, came from an earlier comment made by this person, which basically they said, we have really high staff turnover in our organisation and almost everyone in there is new right now. And then when he went on to say the quote, I sort of tried to pull it out a bit further, and he pretty much said, well, it works for us. That method works for us because, you know, people get the job done. And I kind of reflected on that when I was writing my blog, and I kind of came to the realisation that this guy's created a working environment comfortable for him, because whilst that works for him right now and their organization, the ability for them to grow and go forward and stuff, that's kind of stifled by just having these really concrete fixed ways of doing things, which are time consuming and take people ages to get their feet under the desk. You kind of, with an organization with high staff turnover, you're kind of flat then for 3 months while somebody gets their feet under the desk.
Yeah, I couldn't think of anything worse. But great managers and great leaders always build a team with people who add skills to the team or do things that they can't, or maybe they're not very good at. Number five's all about an opportunity to learn.
Yeah, and we've kind of, this has been a theme right through this whole blog, is that the modern day employee bring new skills, and that we're at a really interesting time technologically in the world right now, where there's all this new technology coming through which help people do their jobs. You know, how many, think for us at Sponsor, of how many different platforms of technology we use just to get our job done day in, day out. That obviously we're selling a piece of technology that helps people do that, but to actually run our business, we've got, you know, CRM, we've got a project management platform,
emails,
email platform,
Adobe Creative Cloud,
a calendar platform for
phone.
Appointments.
I've got a phone.
Yeah, well, if you ever answer it.
Oh, we'll edit that out.
And, you know, there's so much of this stuff coming through right now, which just help, because we're a lean organization, it helps us do our job well. And so if you took that to a broader level, a bigger level, all these people with old school ways of doing things, bringing new people in that are only used to doing this, so that, you know, back onto the quote, the guy's asking people to write stuff out, some of those people wouldn't have used a pen since year 10 at school. Like they use iPads and stuff at school now, and they type notes on laptops at university where you lecture. How many kids actually write?
Yeah, not very many. Yeah. They've all got their laptops open, and interestingly, I watch it and I'm like, they're not paying attention. Then I realise, no, actually, they're probably typing notes and things like that. Sometimes they're not.
Yeah,
but sometimes they're on Tinder or Facebook or
blogging about their lecturer.
That's right. That's how good I am.
Yeah, but what that does is provides an environment for us old school people that have sort of done things and learnt things in the old way, to learn from our staff and actually learn ourselves what we can do different and how we can adopt this new technology to provide a better work environment for people.
And without potting people too much, it's naive to assume that just because you might learn by writing something out five times doesn't mean that everybody else learns well that way. Some people are visual, some people are audio, some people need to write things down. So it's not very savvy to just think, well, that's how I would do it, so let's make everybody else do it.
Yeah, well, I actually remember when I was at university, I did a bit of sports psychology and some psychology work there, and that was a proven, back then, you know, 20 years ago, that was proven to work psychologically, that if you wrote things down five times, you would remember it. You know, that was a proven method.
It doesn't mean it's the most efficient way to do it.
But it worked for our generation.
You know, that's because you were used to writing lines.
Yeah, but the thing now is that the new guys, that they watch content. That's how they how they absorb stuff. They watch videos and things like that, and that's how they absorb things. They actually learn by doing rather than being told how to do things.
So this is all about bringing a new sponsorship manager on, right environment, skills, working relationships, environment, all that sort of stuff. But we've written an ebook.
Yeah, we have written an ebook, and this is all about saving time and trying to help people along. And that ebook is called "So You're the New Sponsorship Manager. Here's your action plan for the first 3 months."
That's right. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes, and it's on the website. Thanks for your time, mate.
No worries, mate.
With a commercial sporting CV that spans 16 years, multiple countries and multiple sports, and with roles not just at rights holders and brands, but also governing bodies, Michael Thompson is well placed to provide a well-rounded view of the sponsorship industry. So I invited Michael on the show to discuss how the different sectors view sponsorship, how the industry has changed, and how mature the market is. We also chatted about the skills brands look for in sponsorship managers they are dealing with on the rights holder side, and also where Michael thinks the industry is heading. Here's Michael. Michael Thompson, General Manager, Participation and Sustainable Sports at the Australian Sports Commission. Welcome to Inside Sponsorship. You have quite a rare CV, having worked in senior commercial positions all over the world and from all angles in the sports industry, be it governing body, rights holder and brand side. Give the listeners a bit of a rundown of your career.
Sure, Daniel. Thanks very much for having me along. I started actually working in sport in 1999 at the Sports Commission on a secondment from a law firm. Spent about a year here and then went over to London to do a master's in sports law and ended up working for a company called ISL. ISL at the time was the biggest sports event marketing company in the world. It was established by the Adidas Group, Adi Dassler, and basically was a rights broker for FIFA, for FINA, for IAAF and a number of other major properties in sports sponsorship. From there, they actually they made one or two poor commercial decisions. It was a company that was valued at about $2 billion US. It was privately owned by three or four people, and they invested in a few things that didn't work out, and FIFA ended up taking them over. So FIFA set up FIFA marketing. I went from originally starting off as a lawyer for ISL to be head of business affairs for ISL for FIFA marketing, and then interim CEO of FIFA marketing for a little while. After about 4 years there, and so worked on the 2002 World Cup, after about 4 years there, I was approached by FFA, who had recently appointed Frank Lowy as chairman, to come back to Australia to help them set up their commercial program. So I spent 18 months helping establish the A-League commercial program, bringing the Socceroos back to Australia. So the Socceroos hadn't played in Australia for almost 3 years.
And we thank you for that.
By that time, the first games we organised were the games against Turkey, and that was off the back of Turkey performing so well in 2002. And then I had an opportunity to join Nike, and so I joined Nike and worked for them for 4 years. I'm a Canberra boy originally, and we had some things happen that brought us back to Canberra. I spent about 2 years at the Brumbies, and then I was lucky enough to spend 2 years at the ARU driving their commercial program as well. At the end of that period, I received a phone call from Nike who said, have we got an opportunity for you? To which I said, look, I'm really happy where I am. And they said, well, what about China? And spent 2 years in China, heading up their sponsorship and endorsements. And after that, I was lucky enough to get an opportunity to come back and work for the Sports Commission. And so now I'm here running a division that covers across participation, sustainable sport, research, and also commercialisation.
And so given the rarity of the breadth of your experience, I want to drill down into the differences between how different sectors view sponsorship. Firstly, you know, what's the role of sponsorship from a governing body that might have associations and teams, so they're both a governing body and a rights holder, the brand side and the individual rights holders themselves? How does it differ?
It's a very interesting, I guess, relationship from a governing body and a rights holder. And the reason I say that is a governing body is also a rights holder. So there's some interplay there in terms of what does the governing body want to protect in terms of category, what opportunities does it want to provide its clubs. It has a revenue perspective that it's trying to drive, but it also has a obligation to assist clubs to drive their revenues. So it's both in some ways a competitor, but in other ways an enabler and an assister to clubs. From a brand perspective, I think it's quite a different economy. Generally, as we know, sponsorship doesn't drive a direct return on investment. It's very hard to measure what return a brand will obtain from associating with an organisation or a club or an event. So for them, it's really more a question of an opportunity to align brand values, a platform to tell a story, and an opportunity perhaps to contact or communicate, have a relationship with a market that it may not find as easy to reach otherwise. It's a very targeted opportunity in some instances.
Mm. And access a market of people that are engaged, that are impassionate, you know, if you can pull in alongside that, there's massive opportunities.
Yeah, indeed. I think that's probably one of the things that, while sponsorship sometimes struggles in terms of a really identifiable return on investment, it's deeper than in an advertising or a marketing campaign at times. It's not necessarily broad brush. It can be very targeted. You can have a really deep conversation with who you want to reach.
How has the sponsorship landscape changed over the years? And do you think the rise of digital has it made it more challenging or easier for good sponsorship to shine through?
It's a really, really good question. And I think it really flows on the discussion we had off the back of the last question. I think digital obviously provides a platform. It provides a platform that is accessible to a whole range of individuals, organisations, brands. It also provides flexibility, the opportunity to change your message very quickly. It allows you to keep costs reasonably low and to drive some innovative messaging. One of the things I think that digital provides is an opportunity to be very, very, very targeted in your messaging, to identify who your consumers are, to be in the places that they are, and to target what you want to say to specific groups, which in traditional media you don't really get quite the same opportunity. You can buy based on viewership breakdowns, but digital takes it to another level.
And I think, interestingly, you can buy it based on readership or viewer breakdown, but there's a leap of faith that what the broadcaster is telling you, you know, we have 50,000 people here or a million people watching there. You know, you can't challenge that. With digital, you can get granular. You can look right down into a rights holder's, Facebook page and see how many 25-year-old females actually like that page or are engaged with it. So we know the importance of sponsorship to actual rights holders. It's an important commercial stream, clearly. But what's the level of importance that, say, somebody like Nike placed on sponsorship or places on sponsorship? How was it viewed and spoken about internally when you were there?
Nike's probably one of the earliest foundation organisations that really has built its business on sponsorship. So the athlete is at the centre of everything that Nike does. The use of teams, of individuals, of events is positioned in such a way to validate everything that Nike is. Nike's a sports company. It produces fantastic product, but its product may not be, and hopefully not too many people from Nike are listening to this, may not be significantly differentiated from some of its competitors' products. Where Nike has been very, very successful is aligning their products with brand fits that really resonate with the consumer and validate the proposition they're trying to put forward.
From a governing body point of view at the ASC, how important is it that our national sporting bodies understand and play the sponsorship game right?
It's very, very, very important, and that's probably as much a reflection of the overall economy that we're operating in at the moment. Funding is extremely tight from all sources. We're seeing organised sport at best holding its own. We are seeing more and more people watch sport, and we see the big deals that the AFLs and the NRLs can generate off their broadcast revenues. But we're very, very conscious and keen for people to participate. How do you participate in sport? Well, you've got to have opportunity. How do you create opportunity? Well, you've got to have sustainable sporting organisations. So for us, it's really important that sports are out there marketing, promoting, driving their own revenue streams. And I think that's probably the two elements of sponsorship that are important for organisations. There's a financial element, because money in the door allows you to do more things. It drives capacity and capability. It allows you to develop product offerings. It allows you to attract the right people to your sport from an organisational perspective. The second part, and probably as important, if not more important, for some of the sports, is the brand element. So it provides an opportunity for an association with strong brands which are going to leverage your sport. They're going to drive awareness and interest in sport. So they become your de facto marketing opportunity.
And a great example is even brands creating and their own events that are sport-based, that aligned, and we're sitting out here just across the road from the AIS, where Weet-Bix brought together a whole lot of family-valued brands, you know, like White Goods and sporting brands and things like that, and ran a triathlon and got the kids participating and the families out here, and it was a fantastic day and all aligned and bringing people out to the AIS.
Yeah, so and that provides a long tail benefit to the sport. It's not just the fact that they're putting money into the sport, it's the fact that, you know, the triathlon here sold out in no time. You've got 2,000 kids experiencing the sport for the first time. Maybe next year they'll think about joining a triathlon club. How will they continue to be involved in the sport?
Yeah, absolutely. And long tail is a good word too, because I took my young fella's bike into the shop. He's still got his triathlon sticker on it. The guy has a conversation with him. Did you enjoy it? Loved it. Are you going to do it again? Absolutely. When is it? He's seven. He's got no idea. It's next year, that sort of thing. So focusing on the rights holders and having worked for a major brand like Nike, what are some of the key things a rights holder should consider when dealing with a brand and trying to present a value proposition to them?
Certainly when you're sitting at Nike or when you're sitting in any of these organisations, a lot of sponsorship proposals come across your desk. The majority of them are, what can you as a brand do for the sponsor property? I think that doesn't really work. That's not what a brand is looking for.
Is that a mindset of the rights holder thinking that the brand needs them more than they need the brand?
Probably it depends on the size of the rights holder. It depends on the type of the brand that's approaching. But I think for the majority, it's just where they're coming from, where they understand what they have. What what successful proposals do is generally they take the position of the brand itself. And so they will say, what can we actually do for you as a brand? You've got a hole here. How can we help fill it? What proposals should do is they should, first of all, start from an understanding of the potential sponsor. If you took a Nike and you have an approach from someone who's going to generate some eyeballs, but not, you know, not massive eyeballs, or not a proposal that will actually put Nike in the game, because that's where Nike likes to be positioned, and they're kind of unique in that sector, that all the apparel and footwear companies are part of the game as opposed to signage around the game. They don't necessarily need brand recognition.
Mm.
What they need is validation. What they need is confirmation on why they're involved. And what we see sometimes is if you don't understand your potential sponsor, you don't understand what they're trying to achieve and how you can assist them achieve it, then the proposal isn't probably as strong as it could be.
And even if that proposal does somehow get up, it's very unlikely to get renewed, because over a period of time they're not going to feel like they got value out of it.
Mm, mm.
On the flip side, what are some common misconceptions that you see from brands towards rights holders?
Firstly is sometimes brands go in with an approach that they don't really think enough about leverage. So they buy an asset. The asset could be a very good one. It could meet their needs. But a brand has to commit as well. It's more than just buying the asset. It's how do you actually drive the association? How do you drive the returns? Sponsorship is effectively a platform. It's like buying an ad on a TV in some extent. That it's not a problem to have that ad on TV or to have the sponsorship, but it's not going to be most effective unless you do stuff around it. So what's your call to action? What are you trying to achieve out of that alignment? The second thing that I think brands need to think about and really drill down deeply into, what assets are they actually buying? What access to the assets do they have? There was a major sport about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, who sold to a sponsor the opportunity to have a logo on every child playing their sport across the country. The marketing director, they did the deal. The marketing director spent a couple of weeks driving around the country, phoning up the sport saying, I'm in Wagga now and I haven't seen my brand. and it's partly because, one, did the sport have the opportunity to actually enforce that? And secondly, how was it going to be done? So you need to understand what the asset is and what the asset brings.
Yeah, and I think even from a, it'd be interesting to see if you agree with this, but even from a brand side, not just saying yes to elements in a sponsorship that you don't really understand how you're going to leverage or even what it is, but saying yes because you feel as though the rights holder is giving it to you and so it must be okay. I hear stories all the time about mostly sort of medium-sized sporting organisations ringing up a sponsor and saying, we've got the such and such grand final on this weekend. Just wanted to check in on what activation you're going to be doing at halftime. Oh, I thought you guys sorted that out.
Yeah,
so indeed. The brand's got some responsibility to say, put your hand up and say, I don't actually know what an activation is. I don't know what this means. How does it help me achieve my objectives?
And I think we're seeing also that the better sporting organisations are now starting to move into the space of not just providing the asset, but assisting in providing an opportunity to leverage.
They almost have to if they want to. They want that relationship to be successful and then it be easy to renew, don't they?
Yeah.
They've almost got an obligation. We hear a lot about big sports and big brands dominating the sponsorship landscape. How can some of the smaller brands and smaller organisations operate in the sponsorship space effectively?
It is a challenge to us. 23 million people... allocations are only so big in terms of sponsorship, and we do see the big boys going very hard and providing a lot of opportunity for sponsors. But that's not to say that the smaller sports can't be successful in this space, what they need to do is they need to think about what they're offering and who their market is and what the opportunity is. Maybe you're a sport that's got a high proportion of mothers in it, and so you're more appealing to a white goods manufacturer, to use a sort of poor example, but yep. but an example. Or possibly you have high net worth individuals who play your sport or associated with your sport, and so
or dads and power tools. We yep. love those.
So the opportunity to you need to know who plays your sport, and you need to know what value propositions you can provide. But smaller sports can really operate in interesting niche areas that are hard to reach, that you can have a deeper conversation with. So there are opportunities, but first of all, you need to know your sport, and then you need to know who you want to target. So if you're a company that's interested in getting to high net worth individuals, you're a financial company of some sort, maybe equestrian is a sport for you, or maybe rowing is a sport.
Sailing.
Or sailing. So pitching to the right people, they're different opportunities. They're not just raw numbers, but you've got an opportunity to connect on a deeper level.
I think that sometimes the medium sports or even the smaller sports think that they need to go after the big recognised brands as sponsors, and it's going to change their world. But there's probably way more value. It's the smaller organisations are going to be more nimble. If they're aligning with partners, like you said, and access some of those niche opportunities, those partners can be quite nimble as well. If you're, I don't know, the ACT something sporting association or Sydney Sporting Club, I don't want to put a sport out there and pretend like I'm making this up, but you're trying to go for Telstra, it's not going to happen. But if you can work with local people and they can access local markets, they're going to be way more nimble and be able to work with you as well, aren't they?
Yeah, and we certainly saw that a lot with Nike, that Nike is not generally interested in the smaller brands because they don't have the reach and they don't have the breadth. But another manufacturer, perhaps one starting out, may be much more interested in getting involved, perhaps cycling or something like
that. Looking through a different lens now, we've spoken on the podcast recently with Mark about recruiting staff and what to look for. What do you think some of the attributes from a sponsorship management point of view are valued both by the sponsors but also the senior management in a rights holder?
It's interesting. I had a discussion with a major sporting club recently, and we were talking about the same sort of thing, and their view was character first and talent second. Make sure that the person fits the organisation first and then has the ability to develop. What I like to see is I like to see proactive. I like to see people who are front foot, getting out there, coming up with ideas, that have people skills, because what we do around sponsorship is people skills. It's all about relationship. They're willing to learn, and they're willing to roll up their sleeves and get the basics right.
Yeah, because while skills are important, you can teach somebody skills, but it's pretty hard to teach somebody a new attitude, isn't it?
Yeah, indeed.
Overall, the sponsorship landscape is a $60 billion market, and your rare experiences seeing this market in action in some of the world's major players, and more recently some smaller sporting organisations, how does Australia stack up from a maturity point of view in terms of attracting sponsorship, but then also delivering and retaining them?
We're a tough market because we're a sporting culture. We've had sponsorship for quite a long time in sport, and both the sponsors and the rights holders are very sophisticated about what they want to do. I think Australia probably leads in a lot of areas around sponsorship, and I think the challenge for us is we've got a limited audience, and we've also got limited funds to access. So,
and it's crowded.
So we've got to get better and better and better. And so we have, I think, it's probably one of those areas that the competition has driven our abilities to actually drive result.
Crystal ball time. Globally, where do you see the sponsorship industry heading?
I'm very confident that sponsorship will continue to increase. I think what we're seeing now is a fragmentation and differentiation of markets to a greater extent than we've ever seen before. And so how do you cut through the noise? How do you make a relationship? How do you drive an outcome if you're a brand particularly? It's probably now less about eyeballs and signage. I think we probably came from a position where it was all about getting your brand on the fence, and now it's about the quality of interaction, personal communication, affinity for brand values. So the organisations that can nail that, both from a rights holder and also from a sponsor perspective, will be the ones that will have real cut through and achieve stuff.
Michael, if people want to get in touch with you, find out more about the Australian Sports Commission, what can they do?
They can visit our website, or I'm happy if they want to drop me an email as well.
Excellent. Michael Thompson, General Manager, Participation and Sustainable Sports at the Australian Sports Commission. Thank you so much for taking us inside your career and experiences in the industry.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Considering the breadth of Michael's experience, it was a fairly wide-ranging discussion, so there should have been some great advice no matter what type of commercial role you hold. As a senior executive at the Australian Sports Commission, I know Michael is a very busy man, so I'm sure we all really appreciate the time he so generously gave up to share his experiences. If you want to find out more about the Australian Sports Commission, simply head to www.ausport.gov.au. Just like Marty and John, if you want to connect with me on LinkedIn, then just search for Daniel Oyston or drop me an email at daniel@sponsorv.net. Your reward will be a shout out on the show. And look, if you've got any sponsorship questions or want to discuss a certain topic, brand or sport, then let me know and I'll see what we can do. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to receive all our content straight to your inbox. Simply head to any of our blogs or podcasts at sponsorv.net and fill in the subscription form and we'll deliver the content to your inbox each week. Of course, if you've got 2 minutes and you love the show, then be sure to head to iTunes and leave us a quick review. It makes a huge difference in helping others discover the show, and so we'd really appreciate it. Until next time, thanks for listening to Inside Sponsorship.
Thanks for listening to the show. For more episodes, blogs and resources, head to sponsorv.net or search for SponServe on Facebook, Twitter or LinkedIn.